Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, athletes and non-athletes, to another episode of Live Like an Athlete. Thank you for joining us again. And if you're new, then we welcome you, and we're very happy you're here. I'm your host, Erin Sharoni. I am missing my partner in crime, Big Herc, again. I'm sure he's probably off somewhere training his biceps, because that's what he likes to do, or eating a taco out of a helmet. Or maybe after last week's episode about injury prevention, he is somewhere healing in a cryo sauna. Nevertheless, we will fight on without him, and I promise he'll rejoin us next week, hopefully in one piece. Speaking of staying in one piece, before we proceed, our usual CYA disclaimer. I want to remind everyone listening that in no way, shape, or form should this be considered medical advice, a substitute for professional opinion, etc. This is for your personal entertainment and edification. Please advise a physician before beginning any exercise program or making any changes to your diet. That's out of the way. So without Herc, I have no one to banter with, which means you're stuck with me, and we'll have to get down to business and move on to this week's theme and our amazing, incredible guest, who I can't wait to get to in a moment. So look, we're going to stick with the playoffs theme because we're in the thick of it with the NBA and the NHL, and obviously we're seeing a lot of grinded out, down to the wire unpredictability, particularly in the NBA, where it's been one of the least predictable first rounds in a long time, which is good for fans, maybe not so good if you're a fan of a particular team. And obviously this means we're still talking a lot about performance on a very, very high level, an elevated level of play that demands a lot from the body and the mind. So there's a lot more than simply training that goes into creating a body that performs at elite levels. But the question is not just what, but how. So how can the rest of us mere mortals, apply the same science as the athletes do to maximize their performance in and outside of the gym? And our special guest this week is tops in the field when it comes to this subject. And in fact, he's just authored an incredible new book called, appropriately, Beyond Training, Mastering Endurance, Health, and Life. You may know him from his very popular podcast. He is Ben Greenfield. His podcast is Ben Greenfield Fitness. He is a specialist in advanced human performance and nutrition. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Ben Greenfield on. Such a pleasure to have you here, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Erin. And by the way, have you ever actually been in one of those cryotherapy chambers?
No, I have not. But my friend Matt, who's also a trainer we've had on a bunch of times, puts his guys in them, and he told me about it.
Yeah.
Have you?
They're pretty interesting. I have. Although this last month, they actually did a big meta-analysis of them and pretty much found that there was zero research that showed them to actually have any superior effect to just like ice baths or cold showers. So unfortunately, the cost-benefit analysis may not pan out for most people, but they are interesting, and they look really cool when you're standing there or sitting there in your cryotherapy chamber with frosty, you know, cold kind of like emanating from around your head. It looks pretty badass.
Yeah, either that or something out of the Austin Powers movie where they froze that dude.
Exactly. Or
it
Star
actually,
Wars.
It validates my lack of desire to ever sit in one. I was like, this can't possibly be good for you. It freaks me out. So I'll have to
get that. I'm not convinced that they're not good for you, because, you know, you see with everything from cold showers to cold water immersion, a little bit of a decrease in inflammatory-based cytokines. And that's kind of important, because those actually will adhere to receptors in your neuromuscular junction, which is the area where your nerves actually talk to your muscles. So technically, high levels of inflammatory cytokines could inhibit your ability to produce muscle contractions adequately or inhibit your recovery. But the idea is that you can get that same downregulation of inflammatory cytokines by, say, like, you know, again, like a cold shower or a cold bath or something like that.
Right. And in fact, one of the tips that our last guest had given listeners who couldn't afford a cryo sauna, like you said, the cost benefit analysis there, was to do a shower alternating hot and cold. So with caution. But
exactly.
It's going to be a great podcast with you, because listeners, as you can hear, Ben is certainly well-versed in a variety of subjects and will give you the hard science behind it. With that said, Ben, before we get started, I want to give everybody a little background on you in case they aren't familiar. So I'll share your bio. real quick. Ben Greenfield is a coach, author, speaker, ex-bodybuilder, and Ironman triathlete. His science-based approach to discovering a potent balance between health and performance has revolutionized the way thousands of athletes and exercise enthusiasts around the world live, train, and eat. He has been voted by the National Strength and Conditioning Association as America's top personal trainer. He's a certified sports nutritionist, a strength and conditioning coach. He has over a decade of experience training professional, collegiate, and recreational athletes from all sports. He's a consultant for Wellness FX, host of the Get Fit Guy and the Ben GreenfieldFitness.com podcasts on iTunes, author of over a dozen programs and books for optimizing health and performance, including a new one which we'll talk about. He's the owner of EndurancePlanet.com, the world's top endurance sports entertainment website. Ben also trains and mentors physicians, personal trainers, and physical therapists from around the globe via his mastermind Superhuman Coach Network at SuperhumanCoach.com. He now travels around the world competing in triathlons and teaching advanced human performance and nutrition concepts. That is a man who clearly practices what he preaches. So, Ben, you've got quite the resume there.
Thanks. You did a good job reading it or saying it.
Thank you. Yeah, I took that from your website. So, Ben, listen, there's a thousand directions we could go in, but let's begin with the basics. I thought this would be perfect timing to have you on as a guest with the NBA and NHL playoffs underway, as we mentioned, because you're a specialist in advanced human performance. But that's not just limited to athletes, right?
Yeah, I work with a wide variety of folks. And honestly, most of my clients and the people who log and listen to my podcast, according to the magical Google Analytics, are 40 to 60-year-old males and females who are just interested in exercising and a little bit of anti-aging longevity thrown in with some fat loss and some muscle gain and trying to get sick less. So yeah, I absolutely work with a wide range of people above and beyond, just like, you know, people who are wanting to whatever go climb Mount Everest or do an Ironman triathlon or something like that.
Right. Or just not be tired at work all day.
Yeah, exactly.
you can have moderate goals as well. Although some might say that that's not moderate at all. So, Ben, you've got this fantastic new book out. It's called Beyond Training. And I love the inside cover of your dedication, which says, "This book is for every high achiever, exercise enthusiast, weekend warrior, gym junkie, biohacker, and health nut who wants to achieve amazing feats of physical, mental, and lifestyle performance without destroying their body, mind, and life." And Ben, I think that's the key, is without destroying, because most people have been conditioned to equate pain with gain, right? Like that phrase says. But intelligently, your premise seems to be no pain, maybe plenty of gain. So some pain is okay, but chronic suffering doesn't lead to an optimal body and life, right? So can you talk about that?
Yeah, chronic suffering doesn't lead to an optimal body and life. And there's certainly people who overdo it. You know, if we return back to that example that I gave of, for example, inflammatory cytokines adhering to like your neuromuscular junction and inhibiting nervous and muscle system recoveries post-workout, you know, someone who's doing, say, like a CrossFit training session every day or high intensity metabolic conditioning every day have constantly inflamed neuromuscular junctions and then be unable to meet or exceed the previous day's performance. And a lot of times instead experience kind of this gradual decline into adrenal fatigue, overtraining, thyroid dysregulation, hormonal dysregulation, even some gut issues that result from hypercortisolism, like, you know, leaky gut syndrome or inadequate absorption of nutrients or inadequate hydrochloric acid production, which results in inadequate breakdown of proteins. So, you know, there's all sorts of downstream things that happen when you look at exercise as simply being this isolated activity that you do versus looking at movement in itself from a more ancestral standpoint, meaning that if you have your butt planted in a chair for 8 hours a day, then you go destroy yourself at the gym for an hour a day. That's actually a recipe for a lot of biomarker and biological issues that could be stripping years off your life, affecting your sleep, giving you brain fog, resulting in hormone imbalances, giving you, you know, skinny fat syndrome. So there's all sorts of issues that you can create when you're simply kind of throwing yourself against the wall every day as an effort to kind of fight against the sedentary lifestyle. And, you know, the other thing that you got to bear in mind when we're talking about like the whole health versus performance paradox, which is really the lens through which I wrote that book, was not just does it make you perform better or make you fitter or make you sexier or give you a six pack or increase muscle, but is it also healthy for you? Is this idea of kind of how you fuel exercise? Because like for me, you know, I've done 10 Ironman triathlons, and I can tell you one way to go pretty dang fast in an Ironman triathlon is to eat sugar. It's like that stuff burns fast. It gives you energy. You know, I'd go through 4 gels an hour during Ironman. But on the flip side, you know, whether we're talking about a basketball player guzzling Gatorade or a triathlete, you know, taking in gels, you also shut down fat oxidation. And you create a lot of inflammatory byproducts called reactive oxygen species and these other byproducts that affect your brain called advanced glycation end products when you're consuming sugar as a primary fuel versus, say, fats and amino acids. And so, yeah, they'll help you perform better, but they might also strip a few years off your joints, give you wrinkles faster, affect your risk for Alzheimer's or cognitive dysregulation. So, yeah, I mean, it all comes down to health versus performance and finding the ideal combination between those two. That, in my opinion, is what's most important. And that's really my, you know, what I feel my calling in life is teach people how to win, how to do cool things with your body, how to achieve amazing feats of physical performance, but do it without destroying yourself.
Yeah, and I love that and appreciate it. You're speaking my language, dude, seriously. In all of our past podcasts, inflammation has ended up being sort of the central topic of discussion, whether intentionally or unintentionally, which really suits my fancy because it's something that I certainly beat the drum to a lot in trying to get people to understand that that's the source of the disease, and particularly sugar antagonizes it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talked about the NBA playoffs and, you know, Dr. Kate Shanahan, who helps advise the LA Lakers with their slightly more ancestral, you know, higher fat, lower carbohydrate eating protocol. She and I were recently talking on one of my podcasts about fat cell apoptosis, literal fat cell death, which up until recently was believed to not even be possible. Like you'd convert fat cells into other types of cells, or else you would empty fat cells of their triglycerides and the other things that fat cell stores, but they never truly disappeared, right? And once you start overeating again or you stop exercising, it's like the fat cells balloon back up and you're back to where you were in the first place or even in a worse spot when it comes to fat formation. But in fact, in a low inflammatory state with generally high levels of light to moderate physical activity and kind of this ancestral living, you can actually get fat cell apoptosis. But the key there is that it can't be achieved. Fat cells simply will not die if you have things like high levels of circulating omega-6 fatty acids, high levels of inflammation, things of that nature. So it is kind of cool that you can actually kill fat cells. But of course, your body has to be in the right state for that to happen.
Now, you know some pharmaceutical company is going to take that and run with it pretty soon, right?
Well, actually, there is. You can, speaking of cryotherapy, you can get fat loss surgery that involves cold application over areas where you have high levels of subcutaneous fat.
That's right.
And that's another way to kill the fat without skin damage. But that's also spendy versus, say, just like eating healthy food and shutting down inflammation.
Right. And also is complete treatment of the symptom rather than the root cause, which ultimately doesn't fix anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. And in fact, we don't really even know what the side effects of that cold sculpting could be. But anyhow, I digress. I want to touch on something that you brought up a couple times in your answer before, where you talked about aging. And in your book, I believe one of the chapters even is about exercise making you age faster. And I thought that that was something really interesting that not a lot of people talk about when they talk about the context of fitness and health. You're not necessarily talking about aging from exercising, but you offer a couple of really interesting examples, particularly how folks who engage in really strenuous physical activity, whether they're NBA athletes or whether they're just weekend triathletes, and how they're increasing the aging process. And maybe you can explain that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, when you're exercising, you're consuming high amounts of oxygen typically and using that to produce ATP. And one of the byproducts of that are reactive oxygen species or free electrons. You're essentially, I mean, your body is an electric machine. And when you are engaging in electrochemical reactions to a higher extent through exercise, you're simply going to induce more oxidative stress and more generation of these reactive oxygen species. Now, the issue here is related to another term that I think I already brought up, and that is this idea about advanced glycation end products, or what are appropriately called AGEs. Now, AGEs are something that stem from what's called a glycation reaction, which is when you add a sugar molecule to a protein, or in some cases to a fat, and when glucose binds with a protein in your body, that's a process called glycation, and that will make your cells stiff and less pliable, and it affects connective tissue, you know, and skin. It affects the neurons in your brain and can result in what are called neurofibrillary tangles in brain tissue. It can affect your joints and the health and the suppleness of your joints. And you tend to see athletes, especially athletes who are creating a lot of reactive oxygen species in conjunction with high amounts of chronic sugar intake, have higher levels of these advanced glycation end products because those free electrons generated by the reactive oxygen species advance this glycation process to an even greater extent. So over-exercising plus high sugar intake is a very quick way to age yourself. And this is why if you look at a lot of athletes up close, even if they have nice bodies, a lot of times you do see some issues like dry hair, skin, and nails. And you see more wrinkles like around the lips, around the eyes, areas where advanced glycation end products tend to show up faster. And I got news for you. Your connective tissue is not just skin deep. What you see going on in the skin level is something that is occurring as you go deeper into the body, down to the joint level. I mean, you've just got layers of connective tissue. So if you're wrinkling on the first layer, you're wrinkling on your other layers too. You're getting cross-linking and less pliability in the rest of that tissue. And so this is an issue for both brain health as well as for beauty. And so, you know, one of the best things that you can do, of course, is to limit the amount of reactive oxygen species you're producing, to shut those down to a certain extent through smart use of, you know, things that are going to fight oxidative stress, and then to ensure that you aren't putting yourself into a situation where you have a lot of glucose available for adherence to your proteins.
Yeah, and people forget that the body is a very elegant machine. You know, you referenced that it's an electric machine, which it certainly is, and the connective tissue is a lot more than perhaps people once assumed, or the Western medical establishment once assumed that it was. It doesn't just hold you together. It also acts as an electrical conductor, so, you know, which acupuncturists obviously have understood for thousands of years. That's a whole other discussion. But I do actually want to talk about the body being an electric machine a little bit later on, because you have a very interesting device which uses some interesting scientific premises regarding electricity, and you know what that is, and I want to get to that in a minute. But before we move on, you brought up the brain, which I actually had as my next question, so we must be synchronized somehow, Ben. there's this thing called biohacking, and for anyone out there who hasn't heard of it, you could just Google it real quick. It's kind of a cool term. I love the idea. It's misappropriated sometimes, but you address it really well. And we recently had a great guest, Dr. Harry Karasidis. He's one of the leading brain docs and concussion experts in the country. We talked to him about that, but you talk in the book about, quote, hacking your brain for better performance, better clarity, better IQ. I'm assuming anti-aging. You referenced the brain tangles a minute ago. So talk about brain hacking and you know, how people can improve their brain health so as to improve performance and quality of life.
Yeah, sure. I mean, when we're talking about just like base level brain hacking, very, very simple. If folks are already engaged in physical activity, there's some really interesting studies that looked at brain cortical activity and actual changes in different lobes of the brain as far as blood flow to the brain, information of new neurons. And what they found is that if you can somehow combine physical activity with novelty, variety, and challenge, meaning new things presented to you in a variety of different ways that actually challenge you both mentally and physically, then this is like a Sudoku on steroids, basically, in terms of how quickly you can enhance growth of new neurons and have, you know, an anti-aging blood flow effect to the brain. So what this means is that if you are the person who goes to the gym and hops on the treadmill and jogs or runs for a half hour and then goes through your dumbbell routine or your machine routine at the gym, and that's your workout 3 days a week, and you know, maybe it's yoga on the other days of the week, and you know the 20 poses in yoga, you're not doing yourself any favors from an anti-aging standpoint. Whereas if you are the person who is maybe trying one new sport a week, so for me that's Sundays. Like Sundays are the day that I don't have a workout at the gym, but I have to go out and do one new sport: rock climbing, ultimate frisbee, frisbee golf, mini golf, anything where I'm moving and challenging my brain at the same time. And then you're also introducing exercises that combine a lot of the elements that I talk about in my book, like balance, mobility, strength, power, speed, but you're engaging in a wide variety of these modes. That's a very simple example, you know, completely sans smart drugs or anything like that, where you can hack your brain just through the type of activity that you do. And, you know, if you wanted to, you could even take this to the next level and you could install something like Lumosity or NBAC training on your smartphone, and you could literally be on an elliptical trainer or a bike or a treadmill trying to move your limbs and play a brain challenging game at the same time. And that will have a literal anti-aging effect upon your brain. So if you can figure out a way to kind of make yourself think and exercise simultaneously, there's some pretty cool brain hacking effects. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I love that.
Yeah, it's this whole idea of turning off versus keeping your brain on while you're exercising. So very important to think about whether or not your brain is on. And you can start simple too. You could even listen to a complex audiobook or a podcast or something like that while you're exercising, and that counts if you're actually paying attention to it and learning while you're exercising. So that's something that I do quite a bit, is I'm always listening to an audiobook or something like that while I'm off, you know, doing squats in my backyard. So there are all sorts of places you can start when it comes to that. Now, there's also supplements, of course, and smart drugs and brain-building foods. So examples of that, curcumin has a really potent anti-inflammatory effect in neural tissue. And one of the things that I do every day, and curcumin is an extract of turmeric, you know, the common Indian spice. I'll start off any day where I have had alcohol the night before, or I've had less sleep than I would have liked to have had the night before, or I've been traveling and have been exposed to a lot of the oxidative stress that occurs during airline travel and movement across multiple time zones, I'll start off with a gram of curcumin. Okay, you can find this at your health food store. You can find it at, online, whatever. But basically a gram of curcumin extract, and I just have that in the morning on an empty stomach. That's an example of a brain anti-inflammatory technique. Another example of a brain hack that I'll use is I'll use a stack of caffeine with L-theanine, and that's found in natural amounts in green tea, but you can also get green tea extracts or green tea powders or like a matcha green tea that you can stir into ice water or into a cup of hot water that has a little bit more concentrated levels of L-theanine and caffeine. L-theanine enhances alpha brainwave production while also combating some of the anti-sleep effects that caffeine can have. So it almost elongates the neurotropic or brain-enhancing effect you get from caffeine without keeping you awake at night. So you can combine something like that with another neurotropic that for exercisers also has the added effect of enhancing muscle power and strength, and that would be creatine. So at about 5 grams a day, creatine has a really nice nootropic and brain-enhancing effect. We all think of it as a power and strength supplement, but creatine along with caffeine and L-theanine is something that I do almost every day just as a way to kind of keep my brain turned on without using, you know, Red Bull and harsh central nervous system stimulants and things of that nature. The other thing that you need to realize is that anytime you're doing anything like this, from exercising while concentrating on something that's difficult to concentrate on, or taking caffeine and L-theanine and creatine to enhance brain activity, anything you're doing that requires your brain to work harder is going to deplete your levels of acetylcholine, one of your excitatory neurotransmitters in your brain, pretty quickly. And so you need to eat choline-rich foods on a daily basis if you are going to enhance cognitive performance. And that would mean eggs with yolks, walnuts, krill oil or fish oil, sardines or wild-caught fish, basically anything that's a good source of choline. Because what will happen is once you run out of that excitatory neurotransmitter, no amount of smart drug or smart activity on the face of the planet is going to keep your brain kind of buzzing along. So you know, there's a few little techniques here, and you know, I've got – I don't remember how many pages, but dozens and dozens of pages in my book devoted to kind of combining all these tactics. But you know, that's a few examples of what I mean by brain hacking.
I love it. So you've got to squat while reading and taking curcumin and eating eggs.
That's right.
That's what it boils down to, more or less. But kidding aside, though, I love the idea of, you know, like you mentioned, the versatility, the diversity, needing the brain to stay flexible and not just sitting on an app or on a computer program, which stuff like Lumosity is fantastic and I love it, but combining that with actual movement, people forget that movement also requires your brain as well, whether voluntary or involuntary. So I think that's a fantastic recommendation. And real quick, again, with the brain, I want to touch on how the brain breaks down. And you mentioned that briefly in your last comment, but in terms of relating it to athletes and sports, since that's what we're doing here, I'm going to use the example of the New York Rangers goalie, Henrik Lundqvist, who some might blame for last night's horrible loss. And keep in mind, folks, that we're taping this on a Wednesday, so by the time it airs, they may have played a Game 7. But I tweeted this fact last night. The guy is 0-11 in games where his team is leading a playoff series. So look, this is obviously not an effect of poor conditioning. We know he can play. He looks like an acrobat on the ice. He's physically in good condition. So I'm assuming that there's some sort of mental component, whether it's emotional, whether it is your neurotransmitters, whatever the case may be. So let's talk about like brain breakdown, because I know that's a chapter in your book too.
Yeah, typically brain breakdown, it happens one of two ways. One way that it can happen is due to neurotransmitter imbalances or neurotransmitter depletion. And there's a lot of things that can cause this. Antidepressants are really one of the more common things that you see these days, you know, specifically selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which actually are going to eventually cause you to need more and more levels of the neurotransmitter serotonin to actually regulate your mood and regulate brain activity. However, there are a lot of other things that fly under the radar that can either deplete neurotransmitters or cause an imbalance in your inhibitory and your excitatory neurotransmitters. And short term, these things don't have much of an effect, but then long term, they start to affect mood. They start to affect focus, your ability to be able to think for long times on certain tasks versus getting distracted and kind of having the look over there, shiny penny type of thing. That actually can be a neurotransmitter issue, not just a focus issue. And of course, it can affect your ability to fall asleep at night, or to not wake up at 4 a.m. in the morning with thoughts racing through your head, or to, you know, not have brain fog at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. So a lot of these are neurotransmitter issues. Antidepressants are one way that you can break the brain via that method. Higher doses of caffeine, in which you actually have to grow more receptors for the neurotransmitter that's going to act opposite to caffeine, called adenosine, that can actually cause a real weakness in some of the neurotransmitter activity in your brain. It's one of the reasons why, and this is something I talk about in my book, it takes about 7 to 12 days to reset those adenosine receptors in your brain. So if you are a coffee drinker, every couple of months you should switch to decaffeinated for 7 to 12 days. Or you can use my technique, and that is that I buy both decaffeinated and caffeinated organic coffee, and I blend it at about 3 parts decaf to 1 part caffeine. So I'm never overriding those adenosine receptors, but I'm still getting some of some of the detox effects of caffeine, some of the, you know, I just like the taste of coffee in the morning. Like, I like my cup of coffee in the morning, but I'm pretty careful with the amount of caffeine that I actually dump into my system from that standpoint. And like I mentioned, I do a lot of L-theanine from green tea as well. A few other things that can affect neurotransmitters. One that flies under the radar is mycotoxins and mold. I mean, if you live in an urban environment, you should have a HEPA air filter in your home or in your office, period. If you really want to take things to the next level and mitigate a lot of the effects of electromagnetic field exposure from Wi-Fi routers and computers and what are called positive ions that are released from those type of machines, you would get a HEPA air filter with what's called a negative ion generator in it. You can get something like that for $100 off of Amazon, but that's really important because those type of toxins can affect the production of neurotransmitters and your sensitivity to neurotransmitters. Your gut is where you make a bunch of your neurotransmitters. So if you have floral imbalances, if you're on antibiotics, if you're not eating fermented foods, all of those type of things can affect your body's own ability to create neurotransmitters. And probably one of the other issues I see in folks, especially like vegans and vegetarians, are just a lack of essential amino acid intake. And amino acids are necessary precursors for neurotransmitter formation. So just inadequate intake of a whole source of proteins. I'm not a high protein guy, but ensuring that by the end of each day, you've actually taken in all the full spectrum of amino acids. That's really important for neurotransmitter production as well. And a lot of times in athletes, there's simply not enough intake of a full spectrum of amino acids. So that's one way the brain can break is neurotransmitters. And then the other way is via what's called your HPA axis or your hypothalamus pituitary axis. Yep. And that is basically aggravated from hypercortisolism, just basically high amounts of cortisol or high amounts of stress producing inflammation that affects your hypothalamus. And eventually you break your adrenals, you stop producing as much cortisol, and your pituitary gland and your hypothalamus are no longer stimulated by your kidneys. And you start to experience things like depression, loss of focus, disruption of sleep, things of that nature. And you do see that in hard charging athletes. And a lot of times you see both these things happen at once in people, neurotransmitter imbalances combined with HPA axis disruption. And it's a pretty big issue that essentially causes your brain not to work the way that your brain should work. And yes, if you find yourself forgetting words or falling asleep in the afternoon or just having a hard time focusing, you know, going from checking emails, checking your browser, checking Twitter, checking Facebook, to jumping into a book, to opening a piece of mail. Like, a lot of that can simply be due to some of these broken brain issues.
Yeah, and I would point out that probably people who are listening are going, oh my God, that's me. So the HPA dysregulation, the hypercortisolism, the adrenal burnout isn't something that just affects athletes, it affects the majority of the first world population for a number of reasons. But that's certainly something that anyone who's listening who's experienced any of those problems, which I imagine like 90% of you have, you should certainly check it out. And Ben's got a great podcast where I'm sure he's addressed that in the past and his blog posts and stuff like that. But Ben, I want to jump back to something that you mentioned earlier when you were talking about coffee, because I too enjoy the taste of coffee, as do I presume a lot of people who are listening. And in fact, I do the Bulletproof coffee, which I know you do also. And I do also actually mix the decaf with the caffeinated coffee, but I do 50-50. So maybe I'll try your way. We could have a whole episode about nutrition, and obviously we don't, you know, have all day. So I'm just going to ask actually a couple of listener questions. Through Facebook and Twitter, we got some interesting questions, and I think it's a good enough segue going from Bulletproof Coffee to going into this one. At a Running Chick says, question for Ben Greenfield. I'm doing a ketogenic diet, but my numbers never show them in ketosis. Could supplements affect these numbers? The reason I'm asking this, Ben, is because it's something that I personally have experienced and have had to figure out on my own. And also because I think people, and we've done a number of shows on what ketosis is and all that stuff, so you don't have to explain that necessarily. But there's a number of factors outside of supplementation that could be affecting. And I think a lot of people are confused as to like macronutrient ratios and the role that hormones play, in particular with women, which mm-hmm. you address so eloquently in your book. You know, with us women checking our blood and for ketones and thinking, oh my God, I'm not at 2.0. This is terrible. Not necessarily. So answer at a running chick.
Yes. So basically, to answer your question directly, anything that is going to disrupt the ability of your Krebs cycle to take fatty acids and convert them into ATP is going to lower your ability to raise blood ketones, because the byproduct of fatty acid conversion into ATP energy is the production of ketones. So the more fatty acids that you have churning through your mitochondria, the more ketones that you're going to produce. And the number one thing that will knock fatty acids out of that cycle and shift you towards glycolysis rather than fatty acid oxidation is the presence of glucose in the bloodstream. And the way that glucose would become elevated in the bloodstream, even in the absence of a high carbohydrate intake, which I'm assuming you're not doing if you're going after ketosis, would be number one, caffeine, speaking of coffee, which causes liver glycogenolysis. So caffeine is going to cause your body to break down liver glycogen, which is an extremely reliable and quick source of glucose. It's what you would tap into if you were going to, you know, if a lion jumped out of a tree while you're walking in the forest, you know, liver glycogenolysis would shove blood glucose up no matter, you know, how starved you are. Your liver always has this little storage of glucose that it can just use in a time of need like that. And that's one thing that you'll see is that caffeine intake can shift you into glycolysis. And that would simply be a matter of adjusting your intake of supplements to make sure that you're not taking in too much caffeine. It's kind of a catch-22, because moderated levels of caffeine can enhance fatty acid uptake and utilization, whereas levels of caffeine that get you to the point where you're jittery or hyper-aware can cause that glycogenolysis to occur. So similarly, cortisol can also cause that same issue. So stress can knock you out of ketosis just because of the amount of glucose that you can produce through glycogenolysis. So those would be a couple of things. As far as other supplements, I mean, like, yeah, it's possible that you've got supplements that are like hidden sources of fructose and glucose and sugar, but you know, now, that's just a matter of, you know, and I know you've got intelligent listeners. It's just a matter of looking at the label, you know, and investigating things that way. The other thing that can cause that same type of cortisol release and the inflammation that could potentially shut down ketone production or the utilization of fatty acids is any type of autoimmune reaction. Yeah. And many, many supplements these days, even thyroid medications, ironically, because gluten is very reactive with thyroid tissue, contain gluten. And contain lactose in some cases, soy derivatives in some cases. And if you tend to be sensitive or allergic to those type of things, that can cause an autoimmune reaction that could also knock you out of ketosis. So looking at the actual ingredient profile of the supplements that you use, and you know, I'm shifting more and more towards looking towards supplement companies that use only natural ingredients free of allergenic triggers. You know, Thorne is one that I've been using most often now with my clients, just because of the low level of allergenic triggers in something like that. You know, it's what a lot of physicians, like natural physicians, will use with their patients. Those are some of the things that come to mind. And, you know, again, one quick thing here, of course, with ketosis, there's really only two situations where I ever recommend you even be thinking about ketosis anyways, just because you do have to eat a pretty high amount of fat. It's logistically difficult to pull off. It can be difficult on your thyroid with extreme restriction of carbohydrates. I only recommend ketosis for people who are doing extreme endurance events, who are going for like 8, 10, 12 hours, days on end, who really want to be able to biohack fat oxidation and tap into that as a readily available source of fuel. Or for folks who simply want a little bit of that cognitive brain boosting effect of using ketones rather than glucose as brain fuel, in which case, you know, you do like the bulletproof coffee in the morning type of thing. And, you know, with something like that, though, I mean, if you're working early in the day and kind of tapering off work later in the day, you can just do cyclic ketosis, you know, and basically this almost like this carb backloading approach of all fat, moderated amounts of protein early in the day, actually staying in ketosis, assuming that you've got a little bit of an overnight fast going on. And then when, you know, as the day goes on, once you get into, you know, maybe post-work exercise and, you know, dinner and stuff like that, that's where you break into a little bit of rice or sweet potato or yam or, you know, some wine or dark chocolate or something like that. And, you know, you go out of ketosis, then you enter it again the next day, and there's no issue with doing something like that either.
Right. And anyhow, overnight, as you sleep, your glucose will tend to rise. So for folks who are testing their ketones and their glucose and trying to maintain ketosis and wondering why they're waking up with a higher blood sugar than when they went to bed, if they tested then too, that's normal as well. And there's obviously, this is a much more complex issue that we could probably talk for another hour on, which we only have a couple more minutes left. So in the interest of time, God, there's so many questions here that we had submitted. And unfortunately,
so people need to read my book.
Yeah, you'll just have to read. Exactly. You'll just have to read Ben's book, and we'll have to have him back on another time. But one last question, Ben, because it's actually one that I am sure quite a few people have. It's not uncommon, and it's also one that people might be afraid to ask. And to that extent, the person who asked it asked me in person not to mention his name. And he said, okay, I have a question for Ben Greenfield. And he pointed to his chest, and he said, how do you get rid of these man boobs? So obviously that's not a problem women have, but it is an issue that some men have. And look, the reason I'm asking is because you can address that in part with nutrition, and also it's hormonal. And while we don't have much time to go into it, I'm sure that you have at least some opinion on how to address whatever imbalance is causing something like that, which a lot of men struggle with and not everyone talks about.
Yeah, and look, again, I don't want to insult people's intelligence. Like, you could go do a search for man boobs on the internet, and, you know, the technical term for it is gynecomastia, and you're going to find the same common recommendations popping up over and over again. Avoid foods that are going to be endocrine disruptors, like soy and commercial dairy and, you know, edamame and soy milk and tofu and that type of thing. Make sure that you are increasing testosterone by lifting heavy stuff, getting enough sleep, de-stressing so that you're not creating a lot of these estrogens. And then do healthy things like, you know, have sex, for example, which is going to naturally increase testosterone and decrease estrogens. And I see people doing this, I'm concerned about my man boobs. I'm not drinking soy milk. I'm lifting weights, having sex, you know, trying to sleep a little bit more, de-stressing, all this stuff. And I'll tell you the one thing that flies under the radar that I see over and over again, is guys will say all that, and then you walk into their bathroom and it is just chock full of every endocrine disruptor on the face of the frickin' planet.
Yep.
The shampoo, the soap, the cologne, everything. So I'm going to tell you right now, I have no endocrine disruptors in my cabinet. And there's a whole chapter in my book devoted to this concept of being able to eat whatever you put on your body. But basically I use plain Ivory soap or Dr. Bronner soap in my bath. Okay, or in my shower, and that's it. Neither of those have endocrine disruptors in them, and I only use soap about every 48 hours or so, because a lot of people don't realize soap will actually inhibit your ability to convert vitamin D that you make from sunshine on your skin into usable vitamin D in your body. So I take primarily water showers, and then I'll use soap every couple of days. Okay, and you'd be surprised, you actually don't stink, assuming you're eating a clean diet, by taking water showers and then limiting your use of soaps and not using any parabens, phthalates, endocrine disruptors, anything like that. I shave with Dr. Bronner shaving gel, which is, again, I mean, you could eat the stuff and you'd still be okay. It's like coconut oil and jojoba oil and, you know, these natural oils that are fine for your body. My facial moisturizer, I use olive oil and emu oil. That's it. Those are the only two types of oils that go on my face or go on my body. The cologne I use is essential oil. That's it. The stuff I have is sandalwood. You can get all sorts of different essential oils from a website like, you know, Mountain Rose Herbs, for example. But again, no endocrine disruptors, no colognes and something like that. Cologne that I actually use. What's one more common one I could throw? A deodorant.
Yeah, I put
a little bit of coconut oil in each armpit. That's it. And if you want to, I mean, there's tons of recipes out there for making your own deodorant. Super easy to do. Or you could just use like Primal Pit Paste or one of these companies that makes natural deodorant. But really, it's the guy's bathroom where I tend to see the biggest issue. And I can tell you, you see football players with man boobs. You see this a lot, you know, when they will be out on their practice field and you know, the linebackers and stuff will have their shirts off. I don't know if you've ever been in an NFL football player locker room, but every single freaking mirror has about a dozen plus endocrine disruptors, from the shaving creams to the deodorants to the shampoos to the creams, all over the place.
And you need to do an endocrine disruptor overhaul for all of the professional sports leagues.
Tell you what, I would love to do something like that. It's a pretty big task, and as I think you know, that's a good old boys network.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's not really a network that I'm a part of, even though I used to do some work with the NFL back when I was in college. As an intern, I did some work with injuries. The natural health folks, ancestral living folks, we haven't really, aside from like Kate Shanahan, for example, with the Lakers, we unfortunately haven't really made much of a ripple in professional sports. And the first teams to get on board with this are going to be the teams that all of a sudden have longer career times for the players, less health issues, lower costs associated with injuries. I mean, there's all sorts of downstream effects here. But it's kind of sad that it's not tapped into yet.
Yeah, you know, Ben, it's certainly also a cultural issue, because if you go to some countries in Europe, they're not using the same amount of personal care products that, for instance, Americans are using. So there is something of a social stigma associated, for instance, with the whole deodorant usage and whatnot. And of course, you don't want to smell bad. But any woman who's either had breast cancer or knows someone in the family with breast cancer is pretty familiar, you know, was pretty acquainted with the assertion that deodorants are certainly not good for breast health at all.
And you honestly don't smell bad, and you don't wash away all your pheromones. So I guarantee, guys, eat clean foods and try this water-only approach without the use of endocrine disruptors. Walk into a club or a bar just smelling naturally, not gamey, but naturally, and you aren't going to have any issues with ladies wrinkling their noses and walking away because you smell like you walked out of a cave. It doesn't happen unless you're eating crappy foods and are chock full of endocrine disruptors.
Yes. And in fact, then you won't have man boobs and your pheromones will be wafting as you walk by. So you may have even more success. You never know. Ben, God, there's so much more we could talk about, but obviously we're out of time, and I don't want to take up any more of your time. So I'll just tell everybody to they'll have to read your book for lots more information. We'll have to have you back on. But thank you so, so much.
No problem. And I don't know if we mentioned where you could get the book, did we?
No, I'm going to give everyone the lowdown.
Killer.
You can head over to Ben's website at www.bengreenfieldfitness.com. You can find his new book, Beyond Training, which, by the way, is a bestseller, already number one on Amazon in its category, and it was just published. You can get it on Amazon, and you can also go to beyondtrainingbook.com. You can also find Ben on Facebook at Ben Greenfield Fitness and on Twitter at Ben Greenfield. And of course, he has his own fantastic podcast and blog, which I really encourage everybody to check out. He's a wealth of information, as you can see. You will not find a better source. Ben, is there anything else that I missed?
I think that's it.
Cool. And you know, we usually end with asking for people's recommendations, but you have beat me to the punch, because not only do you have your book, but on your website, you have a great page called Ben Recommends, and it literally lists people. It lists everything from the blood tests he says you should get to food products. And it's just a fantastic, fantastic source of information. I actually find it really useful myself. So thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks for having me on, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And thank you for everybody listening. Remember to drop us a line at likeanathlete@cbsi.com with questions for future shows. We'll feature them. You can follow me on Twitter at Aaron Cerrone to ask any questions, and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes store. Catch you next week.